Hello, hello, and welcome to the road less traveled. Gary L., Gigi's Boo. Hey, Gigi's Boo, where are you at?
Right here.
Hi, Keith.
In the dark, in the booth, in the back.
You in the back. Here you are. Hey, what's going on? What's going on out here in RLM land and Freedoms Network land and Spreaker land and Shoutcast. Yeah, Shoutcast land. All right. What is up? Got a whole chat room here. Can hear okay. Glad. The call of the drums. Gigi's Boo, how are you doing?
Doing really well. You had a rough week, as you know. But doing
what
really well now.
What was that? I had my headset a little misadjusted. I'm sorry. What was that?
I had a kind of a rough week with Daddy. You know, Daddy was really, really critical.
Yeah.
Tuesday night. We were bad, but he made it through.
Yeah.
And we still have him. So that's a miracle.
Yes. Yes, indeed. A little bit touch and go for our
Yes,
little...
it is. Mm-hmm.
And what's Atticus doing?
Well, running around howling. Showing his butt, wanting to get out, see what all them dogs is carousing around. Tonight is must be council meeting for all of them because, boy, they're all hooping and hollering.
Yeah.
After the show, we got to take him out and let him.
Yeah.
I tell him either you're the mayor or you're
Yes, Meister Broward is live. As live as it gets. Yeah, we're still fogging a mirror here.
That's Let me check. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're still
that
following
like
the
mirror,
so we're doing well. Hey, chat room. What's going on? Everybody's wondering if we're live or not. Okay. Okay. Never mind. And the chat room, per usual, Asmo, Barman Grimner, Moose Girl, Kate, Trust No One, Beetle, Chalcedony, Chloe, and... Chloe.
Chloe.
I be Don C. And at work in Java Doctor, Meister Brown, Vinny, Behind the Woodshed, Colfax, Frumpy, Gigi's Boo, Graham Z, Yehovah, Wanatucko, Kozu, M.M. Butt, and Rob Works. Okay. Yeah, they may need to refresh. That happens to me sometimes if I don't refresh the player. I don't know how that works. I guess it gets placed into a large buffer in the cloud land or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Gigi's Boo, you're not feeling too hot tonight either, are you?
No, not really. I've had a little chills and stuff, and so I had me some chicken broth with some garlic and some cayenne pepper, and I feel a little bit better. Having a few chills, but this too shall pass.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's weather changing, and I think we're getting some cold weather coming in.
We're going to get some wet cold weather. I can take cold weather. Ugh. I can take snow, but I can't stand a cold rain and it cold.
Oh, no. Atticus won't go out. He can't get his feet wet.
He don't like that. He just loves the snow, but when it rains, you almost have to take a bulldozer and push him out. He can't stand it.
For a cocker spaniel, a water dog, that I don't know.
Hey, silly.
He's just rotten. That's his problem. Anyway, what we found tonight, everyone, we found this whole accumulation of bizarre and creepy and mysterious and conspiratorial stories. I know no one here in this chat room enjoys any of that stuff.
Well, now a couple of them won't be too. One of them won't be too much. I just found it interesting. The one I'm going to do is one of them's interesting. I think it's no conspiracy, but we do have some conspiracies and some cover ups and things like that to talk about.
Yeah, and let's see where in the world to begin. We have so many different ones.
I can start with time travel if you want me to.
Go ahead and jump off with the time travel. That's a good start.
Okay. You know, time travel has always been a fascinating topic to most everybody. And it's always been kind of a birth to some conspiracies, urban legends. But you can't tell me it didn't happen. Now, there's no clear evidence that time travel exists per se for people who are closed-minded. But people who are open do see it. I want to talk a little bit about Andrew Carlson. And I had seen him one time before on something that was documented about time traveler, about a time travel. And he fascinated me because they showed pictures of him from the 1700s on up. Now, this guy invested $800 in the stock market. And he made over $350 million in just 2 weeks. Now, this was in March of 2003. And the authorities were sure that somebody was doing some inside trading. But they couldn't prove it. And when he was taken into custody for questioning, during which Carlson claimed to be from the year of 2256. And that explains why he did the wise investment. After spending a month in custody, again, no solid evidence to hold him. And they wanted him to face trial. But he was unexpectedly released after an unknown man paid his $1 million bail. And after his release, he's disappeared without a trace. It was later revealed when they were questioning him, Carson correctly predicted the date of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. People say that could be a lucky guess. However, further evidence supports that Carlson's time travel claims. There's no records of this man at all that can be found dating before December 2002, when he insisted he had arrived from the future. Also, since his disappearance in 2003, the feds haven't been able to find Carlson under any aliases. Now the question is, did he return to his own time after the investment plan didn't go like he wanted? Nobody knows. Another fascinating character is Rudolph Fentz. I found this really like most time travel that I have read about. This happened in 1950, and a man that was clad in 1870 garments was seen in the middle of busy Times Square. And he was fatally hit by a car. He was in a confused state and was wearing strange clothes and out of place. And what was found in his pockets was baffling. He had a letter dated 1876, a metal coin good for a beer from an unknown tavern, a receipt for a horse and carriage care, several vintage business cards, and some cash. And everybody said, okay, you can put on an old suit, stuff some stuff in your pockets, wander around Times Square. But there was a few things about the story that kind of brings time travel to mind. First of all, none of the documents or clothing showed any yellowing, discoloration, or rips. They were pristine. It's also unclear why the young man was disorientated and wandering in the middle of the busiest streets. Furthermore, police found no recent records for Rudolph Fentz, but after examining older archives, discovered that a man by the name Rudolph Fentz disappeared in 1876, the same date on the letter that he was carrying.
And what was the date that he was found?
He appeared in 1950, and then several years later is when they found where he had died, or where he had disappeared, in 1876.
That's a pretty amazing story. Uh-huh. that one sounds pretty credible. A lot of them mm-hmm. you don't know about, but that one, wow. Yeah.
Other one is Sinking Tomb in southern China. It was where the next archaeological site began to unseal a 400-year-old tomb from the Ming Dynasty. During the dig, the archaeologists discovered a small ring-like object on the floor of the tomb. Now, did you hear me? On the floor of the tomb. After further investigation, it was found to be a small watch, likely to be Swiss. The tomb had been completely intact and untampered with, so it's difficult to explain how a 100-year-old watch becomes trapped in a tomb 300 years before its time. In fact, Switzerland didn't even exist during the Ming Dynasty. Maybe the success of the Chinese Empire had something to do with the time traveler. Who knows?
Yeah, that's pretty neat. Grimner posted in the chat room that he watched a movie. It's not directly related to time travel, but some interesting time travel aspects. And it's, I'm trying to catch the name of it here. It looks like, is that a foreign movie, Grimner? I'm not pulling the title. But anyway, it's in the chat room. You can click onto it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. What, you got anything else in that?
Yeah, I got a couple of more. One is okay. John Teeter. Am I saying it right?
John Teeter. Yeah, that's a good story. Go ahead.
Yeah. He's probably one of the most well-known time travelers, and he's supposed to have arrived in our time in the year about 2000, from the year 2036. This is when he began communicating with a growing number of people online. He answered questions, giving predictions and advice for the future. And he kind of posted some pictures of his time machine and explained how it worked. It was months after his post began, he simply vanished, claiming that he was going back to his own world line. Although some of his predictions have not held up, like World War III breaking out in 2015, there's some hard things that he would have had to know from the future, sort of like I believe they said about the war between Iraq and Afghanistan, because he hasn't been heard from for the past 14 years, it makes his story all the more mysterious. Now, I got to say this, back around 2000, I was fiddling around on AOL and I've always been fascinated with time travel. Gary will tell you that. And so this chat room that said time travel is possible. So I went in and I talked to this man. I believe it was this man, this John man, because he was very knowledgeable about machinery and different things. And he answered all the questions very accurately. For somebody that if this person was not him, it was somebody that knew a whole lot about physics. And we talked, and I tell him I didn't care anything about going to the future, because I kind of wanted to go backward in time. And he said going backward was a lot harder than going forward, because people who tend to go backward sometimes mess up and want to change history. And I told him I didn't want to change history. I wanted to see it happen. So I found him very interesting, too. And this last one, I'm going to call it the Future Roadside Restaurant. It takes place in the southwest in the U.S. On the alleged haunted Highway 56 in 1972. talks about four female college students had spent the day at a rodeo in a neighboring Nevada and needed to return to their dorm before curfew. Girls were making good time and took a northbound exit that would lead them to the Southern Utah University. It was about that time that the trip began to get very strange. All of a sudden, the road turned into white pavement and ended suddenly at the bottom of a very previously non-existent wall of rock. After turning the car around, they noticed the landscape had entirely changed, with fields of crops and forest that they hadn't seen a few minutes ago. The girls were disorientated and, I imagine, upset, and so they stopped at a diner on the side of the road, and one of the girls rolled down the window to ask for some direction from someone who was coming out of the restaurant. After this, they claimed that they were pursued by futuristic trikes. I would imagine it looks like tricycles, maybe, with jets on it or whatever. And, however, moments after the chase began, they found themselves back on the correct road, bound for home. And the girls later claimed that the person she was looking at looked inhuman. So maybe they had traveled into a far distant future just for a few minutes. So...
wow.
I believe all of them myself. Because I like time travel.
Yeah. And interdimensional things. Kind of similar, you know. Kind of similar concepts. Well, what about missing persons? Anything else you want to talk about? Time travel? Sorry?
You go ahead.
Okay. What about some missing people? A fellow by the name of Benjamin Kyle. Kind of an interesting story. On August 31st, 2004, he was found naked and burnt by a Burger King in Richmond Hill, Georgia. A Burger King employee had found him and called the police. The beaten and unconscious Kyle was then rushed to the hospital. Once he had woken up, it was discovered that he had no memory of who he was. And without any form of identification, the name Benjamin Kyle was formed out of the initials of Burger King. Kyle had three deep impressions in his skull, which people attribute to his amnesia and memory loss. And over a decade later, he still had no memory of his past life or who he had been. Despite all the publicity his case had generated, no one has ever come forward to say they know him or are related to him. Due to the unusual circumstances of this case, there are many theories. Some say he's even faking it. What do you think, Gigi's Boo?
I don't believe he's faking it.
That's a strange one, isn't it?
It is. I don't believe he's faking.
Yeah. And then there's Nicholas Barclay. He was 13 years old. And after playing basketball with his friends in his hometown of Texas, he was never seen again. That was until 1997, when a boy in France claiming to be him was flown to the United States and reunited with the family. Although the boy had different colored eyes to Nicholas and spoke with a French accent, the family believed that it was indeed their son, who had been sold to a prostitution ring and sent to live in France. The boy lived with the family until 1998, when a local private investigator became suspicious of the differences in appearance between Nicholas and the boy claiming to be him. In February 1998, the FBI gained permission to take DNA, and it was found that the boy was not Nicholas, but in fact a French imposter named Frederick Bourdin. Bourdin was sentenced to 6 years in prison and even admitted he could not believe that the family believed he was their son for as long as they did. Some people believe that Nicholas's family are responsible for hiding the whereabouts or perhaps even the murder of their son, and therefore jumped at the chance to have Frederick covered up. A documentary about this case, The Imposter, sheds some more light on this strange case and asks more questions about the family's willingness to accept the boy as their missing son. Now, what do you think about that story, Gigi Sweet?
Wonder what his reason was for it, the being an imposter, just to get out of from overseas? Or
I don't know. It opens up all kinds of interesting questions.
That's... You want to know why he did it. I mean, you know, that DNA wasn't anywhere near a match. Maybe that person was hiding from something.
Mm-hmm. Or, as they suggested here, maybe there was some dark conspiracy between him and the family to obscure the fact that they'd actually murdered their son. That's a really strange story.
It is.
But then you have, in a similar story, a fellow by the name of Walter Collins, 9-year-old boy who went missing while his mother was at work. When she returned home, he was nowhere to be found. She called the police, but was told that he needed to have been missing for 24 hours before they could search. So he took on the search herself, frantically searching the streets for him. I would imagine we would all do.
I would think so.
Similarly, yeah. And after the police faced negative publicity, a boy claiming to be Walter was found, and a public reunion was organized by the police who wanted to gain positive popularity. But on seeing the boy, Walter's mother, Christine, claimed that's not her son, despite dental records proving that the boy was not her son. Captain Jones of the police department had Christine committed to a mental hospital where during this time the boy eventually admitted he was not Walter, but in fact a boy by the name of Arthur Hutchins Jr. After Christine had been released from the mental hospital, a ranch owner named Gordon Stewart Northcott was arrested for a series of abductions and murders of young boys in the area. Although evidence points to this man as possibly being the abductor and murderer of Walter, he had denied ever meeting Walter, and the fact he could not describe Walter's appearance gave Christine hope that her son was still alive. And if you've ever seen the movie Changeling with Angelina Jolie, that was partly based on this case.
Never saw that.
I didn't either. But that's kind of a spooky one, isn't it?
A scary, yeah.
What about Brooke Henson? Now, here's a 21-year-old girl, Southern California. And she was at a party with some friends on July 3rd, 1999. Well, she had a disagreement with her boyfriend, Shane. So she left a note to him at about 2 a.m. and walked to the local convenience store, which is only a few streets away. Brooke was last seen walking along the road to the convenience store and has never been heard from or seen since. But in 2006, there was a sudden breakthrough on this missing person case. Someone with the name Brooke Henson had applied for a job as a nanny in New York. And after the employer did an internet search of her name, contacted the authorities after realizing she had been a missing person for over 6 years. But this was not the good news her family had been hoping for. The real identity of the person claiming to be Brooke Henson was instead a girl named Esther Reed, also a missing person, who dropped out of high school and disappeared from her hometown after her mother's death in 1999. In February 2008, she was arrested and sentenced to 4 years in prison, but the whereabouts of the real Brooke is still unknown, and no more information has ever been found.
Wonder why she took that girl's name.
I don't know. Well, she took that name. It might have just been coincidental. It was attached to a missing person. But, yeah. Huh. Strange. What else have you tripped over, Gigi's Boo? What do you find interesting?
Amazing discoveries by a metal detector. Hmm. You know, I'm kind of one of those people, too. I like that stuff. So.
Yeah, cool.
They say that the hobby has been kind of ridiculed by the media. And people that take up the hobby are wasting their time. The only things they usually find are bottle caps or beer cans, all this other stuff. But in 1944, at the Jacksonville Postal Department, they became suspicious when they began to receive complaints of stolen money from delivery recipients. An investigation was undertaken, but the culprit was never found. The complaints continued until 1945, when a postal employee named Marshall confessed on his deathbed that he was a thief, but he refused to reveal the location of the money. So a search was commenced, and it was during an inspection of Marshall's small backyard that a metal detector began to go off. Police found that Marshall had buried a length of pipe 9 feet underground in his own backyard. And inside the pipe were 2 cans filled with loot. The cans were what set off the detectors. And even though $153,150 was recovered from the pipe, there is still a large sum of the stolen money that's never been accounted for, even today. Smart man, he put it up where nobody can find it. Okay, another one, and I really like this one, and Gary and I had a chat over this. When an amateur from Serrano, Mexico, purchased an old metal detector, in 1989, he didn't expect to find much. After days, he spent scouring the boiling desert with only a few nails to show. He came real close to quitting. Then just about the time he was headed home, the detector picked up something. To his astonishment, he had just unearthed the largest gold nugget ever discovered in the Western Hemisphere, named the Boot of Cortez, because it resembles a conquistador boot in shape. Nugget weighs about 389.4 ounces, a full 100 ounces heavier than the formal title owner. After being put on display for 2 years in the museum, the boot sold at auction for $1,553,500.
Yeehaw.
Yeah, we talked about that. I asked him, I said, no. I don't believe I'd have been so good about turning it in. the other one is about a ring that had been missing for 48 years. In 1974, there was an amateur metal detector named Roy Lloyd. He got a hit on his metal detector one day in Florida. The signal was coming from sediment just beside the lake. And being curious, he dug it up to see what he could find, and he was surprised to see that it was a high school ring from 1926. The ring had the initials of MB graved upon it. Roy became determined to return this ring to its rightful owner and set about placing ads and inquiries. A graduate of the school in 1926 named Miles Barker came forward. Barker accidentally dropped his ring to the lake while at the pier 48 years earlier and thought it was lost forever, which it could have been if it hadn't been for Roy and his trusty metal detector. I thought that was real cool. That would be something really great to get back.
Yeah, that's a neat story.
This is the one that Gary and I talked about, and the next one it's talks about a chalice worth $1 million. And it's 1928, while holidaying in Key Largo, Mike DeMar decided to take his metal detector out for a spin while on a diving expedition. He got a hit, and he almost passed it up, thinking it was probably just some junk. But he decided to investigate. After cleaning away the debris, Mike saw gold shining beneath the sand. Astonishingly, Mike had just unearthed a 385-year-old golden chalice that had most likely come from a ship called the Santa Margarita, which sank off the coast of Key Largo in 1622. The chalice since has been appraised, and its value is estimated somewhere around $1 million. I don't think I'd ever told that. I'd have kept quiet, just like on this next one.
Yeah, that might have found its way into the cupboard.
Yes. In July 2009, Terry Herbert was out metal detecting the farmland near his home in Lynchville, Staffordshire. Terry had no idea that he was about to stumble upon one of the most important archaeology discoveries England had ever seen. He soon realized the importance of his find, and an entire archaeological dig was formed, which unearthed the largest hoard of Anglo-Saxon gold and artifacts ever found, including battle armor, including 66 hilt swords and statues of Saxon deities. There was so much treasure buried at the site that it continued to yield discoveries well into 2012. The total accumulative value of all the gold is $3.285 million, with Terry and the landowner upon whose property the hoard was discovered both received 50% of that sum each. The treasure was split into two parts, with some being on display at Birmingham's Museum and Art Gallery, and the rest put on display at the Potter's Museum in Stoke-on-Trent. Gary and I talked about that. We'd have never turned that in. We'd never let anybody know we got that.
Yeah, we'd have Atticus hooked
up. We'd have melted that stuff down.
Yeah, we'd have Atticus hooked up to the little red wagon pulling that treasure.
You better believe that. Never would I have been honest enough to turn it in. I don't know about anybody else, but I'd have kept that. That and the chalice both. That's all I've got on that one.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that metal detecting and treasure hunting and things of that nature have always fascinated me. I got a metal detector, but here's the thing, you know, it's so difficult to find places that you can actually do it. You know,
we've got right up here, we've got a school,
mm-hmm.
and we've got two brothers who are identical twins, and they have to be in their 80s now,
mm-hmm.
and they have a metal detector, and every Saturday they go up and get on the school ground and go over the whole playground area.
Mm-hmm.
And you see them picking up. They're picking up the kids' change that they had in their pocket and lost. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, you reminded me of the story about the lost Confederate treasury. You know that story,
God,
don't you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's supposed to have crossed right here in this county.
Yeah. That I actually kind of informally did a little checking on it since...
Uh-huh.
The actual rail line that led from Richmond came through this part of the world and then went south. And, I mean, the fact is there were some books written about it. The treasury just disappeared. It was loaded on the train.
Supposed to go to Charleston.
Yeah, it made it into Danville, Virginia, which was the last capital of the Confederacy. And from that point, they tried to move it on, and it just disappeared.
They seem to think that it got off, you know, the train could, because of the amount of money mm-hmm. that they were trying to keep it away from the union,
mm-hmm.
and that they moved it over into wagons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about it, that we mm-hmm. had the river down here we checked into, and it does have a very shallow place that the wagons could have went over.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary and I even did a little scouting around investigating, and I tell him, I said, if we find that, we'll never tell nobody.
Well, one of the theories, and it sounded fairly reasonable to me, is that because at that period, I mean, no one had gotten paid. You know, it was just a mm-hmm. fact. There was no one getting paid and hadn't been paid for a while. That actually, when the train, or the not the train necessarily, but when the gold or silver and so forth made its way as far as Georgia, there was a theory that they decided to heck with it and just split it up, and people took
went on their merry way.
Went on their merry way, right? And that's a reasonable theory. Although it's nice to think that one day you might be able to actually locate that.
We even followed instead of following a wagon train, we plotted out the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
They could have barged it down the river,
mm-hmm.
and we did all that. We got the map and planned it all out.
Yeah,
and I'd like to find it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what the numbers were. It was quite substantial.
Oh yeah, yeah, really, really.
Because the so many people had contributed their savings, and some rich landowners had contributed, and so forth, and even from England, people had contributed.
Yeah. So. And it just wasn't gold. There was some silver in it too.
Oh yeah, gold, silver, and so forth. So, yeah, that would be a fascinating discovery for a lot of reasons. All right, let's see here. How about, what do you think about these people who believe they've lived previously?
Oh, yeah.
Those are kind of
that's
fun.
That's interesting, but.
Yeah, those are kind of fun stories. Like a fellow by the name of Chris Vincent. He became convinced that he was Marilyn Monroe in a past life.
I don't believe that.
Well, during regression therapy, he started to recall specific parts of her life. And on one occasion, he was with Marilyn's mother in a farmhouse. It was completely empty apart from a white object in the front room. Chris later learned that although Marilyn spent most of her childhood in orphanages, she did spend a short time with her mother, who had bought a house on credit, but within a month of the purchase, all her possessions had been repossessed apart from a giant white piano. Chris believes that this is what he saw in the vision. He also claims to have experienced Marilyn's death. He said everyone thinks Marilyn was found naked in her bed after taking an overdose of prescription drugs, but the truth is Marilyn was murdered in her pool house and her body was dragged to her bedroom. He claims there were 5 people involved in her death, despite the vivid recollections of events. He claims he had no previous knowledge of anything to do with Marilyn Monroe. That's pretty interesting.
Because I've always felt like there was some people involved in her death.
I think so, too. I think she was.
She was silenced.
Yeah, she was silenced. She knew too much.
Marilyn was a tormented soul.
Yeah.
And she wanted to talk a lot, so.
Yeah, and she was the direct line to JFK, and I'm sure she shared a lot of information that came out of that relationship.
Uh-huh.
This one I've seen on TV, a guy by the name of James Leininger. In 1945, a 21-year-old fighter pilot, James Houston, I guess, Jr., was shot down and killed by the Japanese during the Battle of Iwo Jima. Many years later, James Leininger was born in America. As he grew up, he started having nightmares. At the age of 2, he would be writhing on his bed, screaming, Plane on fire. Little man can't get out. Clawing the covers as if trying to escape. He would also call out the names in his sleep, and at the age of 3, had an extraordinary knowledge of fighter aircraft. When asked who was in his nightmares, the child replied, "Me." These nightly scenes were traumatic for his parents, and his father Bruce embarked on a 3-year search for the names his son was mentioning. After extensive research, Bruce concluded his son was the reincarnation of James Houston, Jr. He discovered James Houston, or Huston, I guess it is, was shot down exactly as his son was describing. In another astonishing outburst, the young boy said to his father, "I knew you would be a good daddy. That's why I picked you." When asked where he picked him from, James replied, "In Hawaii at the Pink Hotel on the beach." Eerily, this was where James was conceived. This extraordinary story has been told in the book called Soul Survivor, The Reincarnation of a World War II Fighter Pilot. You ever heard of that one, Gigi Spoon?
You know, it does ring a bell, and Grim put in here, he sent a link. It's the title, The Boy Who Lived Before, in a chat room.
Yeah, I know there's been a story done on it. Yeah, that's a pretty convincing story, actually. Mm-hmm. Here's a Sherry Leigh Laird, who believes she is the reincarnation of tragic Hollywood legend Marilyn Monroe. And Marilyn gets around, doesn't she? And this claim has been backed up by Malibu psychiatrist Adrian Finkelstein. Finkelstein said he uncovered Laird's past life after placing her under hypnosis as part of a highly controversial therapy known as past life regressions. Laird, who bears little resemblance to Marilyn, was videotaped under hypnosis and accurately recalled love affairs with John and Robert Kennedy. She also stated JFK told her state secrets about Fidel Castro in Cuba and gave details of Marilyn's untimely death at the age of 36, dismissing any thoughts of her being murdered, claiming it was a drug overdose. Okay, so now we're going in the other direction. Okay, so skeptics are divided about this whole process, claiming it can lead to patients genuinely believing they have experienced a past life. So, who knows about that one, Gigi's Boo?
Who knows, but it's convincing, isn't it?
I don't know.
These are, yeah.
What's that?
All of them so far have been very interesting, and the little boy was very convincing.
That one's a pretty good one. Then you have 6-year-old Cameron McCauley, who was a typical little boy who talked to his mother and father and drawing pictures of the house. And the only problem was the life he was talking about was not the one he was living. The little boy said it was his other life and was worried that his old mother would be missing him. Cameron talked vividly about his life on Barra and was getting distressed at being away from his Barra family. He even named his other dad as Shane Robertson and said he had died because he hadn't looked both ways. The Glasgow lad was so convinced that his other life was on the Isle of Barra that his present family, who had never been to the Isle of Barra, decided to take Cameron there. When they arrived, Cameron was so happy, he got off the plane, threw his arms in the air, yelling, "I'm back." After searching the island, they were finally directed to a White House as described by Cameron. As they arrived, the little boy went very quiet. His old mother was not there to meet him. The house was not lived in, but the family had managed to get a key to look around. Remarkably, Cameron knew the house inside out, even showing them a secret entrance. Since his visit to Barra, Cameron talks less about his old life, but he has told pals not to worry about dying because you'll just come back. when his mother asked how he ended up with her, he says he fell through and went into her tummy. When asked what his previous name was, he simply said, "It's Cameron. It's still me." That was a little creepy, Boo Boo Bear. What do you think?
I didn't find it creepy. I think it's, well, you could have another thing about that. We could say something. It's called genetic memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told you about that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been places where actually I really thought I had been before. And it's genetic. It's passed down through the genes. So that could be another explanation for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. There's something that just struck me as a little bit creepy about that. I guess I'm looking at it from the kid's point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, how creepy would it be to go back to a place that you actually recognize, but the people that you expected to see weren't there? They were gone.
Yeah. Hmm. Maybe be sad for him. Mm-hmm. You know.
Okay, what else you got?
Okay, I'm going to go to a lighter note. Well, it's really not lighter, but I found this thing about bizarre last meal requests from death row inmates. And, you know, I had to read it. And death row inmates are generally given a request for your last meal. And, of course, probably I wouldn't even think about that, but there's going to be five that we're going to talk about who did. Victor Fiergrew. He was convicted of murdering Dr. Edward Bartels. He lured the doctor into believing a woman was in need of medical attention. But when the doctor arrived, Fiergrew kidnapped him, shot him, and dumped his body in a cornfield. He was convicted and sentenced to death by hanging. After an unsuccessful appeal, he was held on death row in Iowa State Penitentiary for 10 years before he was hung March 15, 1963. The morning of his execution, he was issued a new suit, and the guards took his last meal request, and he asked for a single olive with a pit left in. After his death, another suit was issued for his burial. When removing his execution suit from his body, the pit of the single olive was found in his pocket. He was placed in an unmarked grave at Fort Mason. And his legacy being his bizarre last meal request and being the last man ever to be executed in Iowa. I found that very unusual, an olive.
Yeah, that's pretty strange.
Ronnie Lee Gardner. He killed Melvin Johnson Oderstrom during a robbery in Salt Lake City in 1984. And he shot an attorney, Michael Burdell, when he tried to escape while being moved to the courthouse for his first murder. He was sentenced to death, and he chose a firing squad rather than die from lethal injection, stating, "I like the firing squad. It's much easier and there's no mistakes." After many appeals and nearly 25 turbulent in various prisons, Gardner was finally executed on June the 18th, 2010 at the Utah State Prison. He was strapped in a chair, the hood over his head, and was shot by five anonymous volunteer police officers. 48 hours before his execution, he requested his last meal of steak, lobster tail, apple pie, vanilla ice cream, and 7-Up. After his meal, he refused to eat anything else. Fasting, it was believed, for spiritual reasons. During the last 48 hours, he watched the Lord of the Rings trilogy and read Divine Justice. At the time of his execution, friends and family gathered outside the prison, holding a candlelight vigil and playing Free Bird by Lynyrd Skynyrd. He was cremated, and his ashes were taken back to Idaho by family members. Thomas J. Grasso. In 1990, he strangled an 87-year-old woman using her Christmas lights, and she lost her life for the $12 she had in her purse and her TV. 6 months later, after moving to New York with his wife, he murdered another 81-year-old woman, Leslie Holtz, stealing the Social Security check. He was originally convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment in New York because they don't have a death penalty. But after being extradited to Oklahoma, who do impose the death penalty, at his request, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection. He successfully halted all his appeals. He didn't want any appeals, and he spent just 2 years and 5 months on death row before being executed on March the 20th, 95. His last meal request was massive. He wanted 2 dozen steamed mussels, 2 dozen steamed clams, a double cheeseburger from Burger King, half a dozen barbecue spare ribs, 2 strawberry milkshakes, half a pumpkin pie with whipped cream, diced strawberries, and a 16-ounce can of SpaghettiOs with meatballs served at room temperature. He issued several statements to the press before his death, one of them being, "I did not get my SpaghettiOs, I got spaghetti, and I want the press to know." Gary Carl Simmons, he was a butcher in a grocery store, and he used his knife to cut up a man, and he fed the man to the alligators in the bayou in 1996. The victim was 21-year-old Jeffrey Wolf, who had tracked down Simmons pursuing a drug debt. An argument broke out, and he was fatally shot. But it was, they're not sure that Simmons shot him. There's no doubt that Simmons was responsible for getting rid of the body. He was convicted and sentenced to death by lethal injection. Before he was executed in June, he requested a massive last meal. 1 Pizza Hut medium super supreme deep dish pizza, double portion with mushrooms, onions, jalapeno peppers, pepperoni, plus 1 pizza regular portion with 3 cheeses, olives, bell peppers, tomato, garlic, and Italian sausage. 10 8-ounce packs of Parmesan cheese, 10 8-ounce packs of ranch dressing, 1 family-size pack of Dorito nacho cheese flavor, 8 ounces jalapeno nacho cheese, 4 slices of jalapeno, 2 large strawberry shakes, 2 20-ounce cherry Cokes, and 1 super-sized McDonald's fries with extra ketchup and mayo, and 2 pints of strawberry ice cream.
Good Lord.
I'm telling you, it was reported that he attempted all of it, but only managed to consume half of the 30-calorie feast.
He ate enough to last him to the resurrection,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Lawrence Russell Brewer, he was a white supremacist, and I remember this crime when it happened. He was responsible, along with 2 others, for the horrific death of James Byrd. He was a black man, and they chained him up by his ankles and dragged him for 3 miles behind a pickup truck. It's believed Byrd was conscious for most of the ordeal and was only killed when his body hit the edge of a culvert, severing his arm and decapitating him. The killers carried on dragging his torso for a further mile before dumping him in sort of a cemetery. He was sentenced to death and executed by lethal injection in the state of Texas, December 21st, 2011. Brewer ordered a large meal of 2 chicken fried steaks, a triple meat bacon cheeseburger, a large bowl of fried okra, a pound of barbecue, 3 fajitas, meat lover's pizza, pint of ice cream, a slab of peanut butter fudge with lots of peanuts. He was presented with the meal, but did not eat a single mouthful, and the whole meal was discarded. Brewer was solely responsible for Texas prison officials ending the 87-year-old tradition of offering a last meal of choice to condemned inmates. The end.
All right. Well, I can think of better conditions to enjoy a good meal like that. Okay, about 4 minutes left. How about some haunted aviation stories and phantom airplanes? What do you think about that, Gigi's Boo?
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's see. Biggin Hill. It was a Royal Air Force station that housed a number of Spitfire fighters during the Second World War. And being located close to the center of London, it was heavily involved in the fighting during the Battle of Britain. Today, Biggin Hill is home to a museum commemorating the battle and wartime fighters that regularly fly displays for the public from the historic runway. However, one frequent flyer over the airfield is not on any earthly flight schedule. Since the end of the war, the skies around the base have rumbled with the sound of a Spitfire's Rolls-Royce engine, despite there being no aircraft reportedly flying in the region. Add to this a number of sightings of a solitary Spitfire making its way towards the runway before vanishing into thin air, and one is left with the feeling that at least one of the few is still trying to find the peace he so desperately fought for in those dark days. RAF Wittering has long been one of Britain's major military airfields, and during the Second World War, the base was a hive of activity with British and American warplanes taking off from there on operations over Nazi-occupied Europe. A curious incident occurred in August 1944 when a young United States soldier on guard duty spotted a bomber apparently coming into land, but its wheels failed to make contact with the tarmac. Instead, it ballooned down the runway. Before, to the young soldier's horror, he watched it charge into the control tower. Bracing himself for the resulting explosion and fire, he was amazed to find, instead, that the bomber disappeared in front of him, just as it was about to hit the control tower. When he reported the incident to his bemused superiors, the story got around the base until it was revealed that during the early days of the war, a bomber did indeed crash into the tower in a manner similar to how the soldier described. Since the war, the new control tower built at the base has had a history of paranormal activity, such as the sound of ghostly footsteps in the stairwell, but the phantom bomber has so far failed to make a reappearance. What do you think about that, Boo Boo Bear?
Them things happen.
That's strange. Let's see. Well, it's time for us to go, Boo Boo Bear. We've run out of time.
Thank everybody for coming tonight. We enjoyed it. I'm sorry I can't talk tonight. There's a little something wrong with me.
Yeah,
anyway,
things,
I hope you can understand me. I love you all, big to my heart. And we'll see you next week on The Road Less Travel. Take it away, Gigi.
You got it, Boo Boo. And we'll talk to you later on. Thanks for stopping by. Take care. Bye-bye.